This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How good was that jobs report today? That jobs report today was so good that the unemployment rate actually went up. Think about that for just a second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 6th day of February. Great, as always, to have you with us. Bafo is a word you might use. Spectacular. Fabulous. Pick your superlative. Go ahead. Pick your own. The January unemployment report we got this morning from the Labor Department measures up. 257,000 new jobs last month. November and December were adjusted upward, which means that in the past 3 months, this economy has added more than a million jobs. Even that increase in the unemployment rate that you've heard of, up a tenth to 5.7%, was good news in its own way because the Labor Department said nearly 750,000 people started looking for jobs last month, which bumped up the rate at least temporarily if you do the math. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going today with who those new job applicants are.
For years, I've been coming to this unemployment office in Portland, Oregon, and it's always packed. But this morning, for a change from even a year ago, everyone I talked to was relatively upbeat.
The market's getting better, but, you know, you gotta keep looking for it.
That's Alan Scott Jackson, 23. Since the recession, he's had short jobs, under-the-table jobs. He's looked on and off. Now he's started searching again in earnest for regular full-time work.
Stores such as Kmart, so retail, painting jobs, janitorial work, and right now I'm looking at temp agencies.
And he's pretty typical. More than 700,000 people joined or rejoined the labor force in January. We don't know much about their education level or previous jobs, but says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute,
people that have entered the labor force in terms of the age distribution is about 72%, which is made up of prime working age adults 25 to 54.
And the recent increase in people joining the labor force isn't equally distributed among population groups.
The uptick may be disproportionately more Hispanic workers and white workers and less black workers.
Economist Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution says the jobs they're finding aren't just low-paid retail and restaurants or higher-paid finance and technology. The middle's filling out, too.
The construction industry has picked up its employment gains. Manufacturing sector has been adding steadily to payrolls for quite a while now.
In January, healthcare was up 38,000, finance up 26,000, retail up 46,000, led by new jobs at auto dealers, sporting goods, book, and hobby stores. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was lots going on this week besides jobs, so we will dig right in here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Arneela Richardson, she's from Redfin. Cardiff Garcia is from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Kat.
All right, so Cardiff, do we think now we have come to a point, not where we don't have to pay attention anymore, but where we can stop freaking out about the jobs report and just assume it'll be at least constant?
I sure hope so. And if not, then I'll be surprised. You know, I, like you, I tried in vain to find something bad to say about this jobs report.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. And I think something I've been following more recently is the extent to which young people, young adults, are also participating right. in the labor market recovery. They were disproportionately hurt by the severity of the recession and by the bad recovery. Now they're starting to participate as well. I think your guy just mentioned the construction jobs yep. were coming back. Well, I think the fact that young people are now involved also means that a lot of them are going to be moving out of mom and dad's basement, out of the house, and they're going to start getting houses and apartments of their own, and that also is going to help propel the economy forward.
Neela, quickly, just to touch on jobs and then move on, anything bad in this thing?
You know, it's something to watch out for is always wage increases. We yep. saw them yep. go up this month. They went after going down in December. So let's make sure that this is a positive trend that we see every month and not a one-time blip.
Okay. We'll keep on zipping quickly through things. Neela, the Federal Reserve, does this change the calculation that rates will go up sometime this year?
I think it does. I think it does. Ooh. We're seeing much more news in the positive direction yep. that wages are starting to increase a bit, that jobs are on a steady pace. You know, interest rates have been zero at 0% rates for a really long time now, and it's time to start having a normal economy again. We don't have one now. We won't have one until interest rates reflect the market rate and not this subsidized rate by the Fed.
Cardiff, channel your inner Janet Yellen for me.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've been sort of hell-bent on signaling that they want a mid-2015
right,
rise.
Right.
I think that stays in place. Remember, a lot can happen between now and the summer. Watch inflation. It's still well below 2%.
Yeah.
If that doesn't start picking up meaningfully, then I think they're going to have a problem doing so.
All right, speaking of having problems, Cardiff, the Europeans and Germany and Greece, they are not getting along. Are you worried about what's going on over there? I mean, they can't even be in the same room, the German finance minister and the Greek finance minister.
Yeah, absolutely I'm worried. I mean, you know, it's amazing that here we are again, and yet Greece is, I think at this point, as close to leaving the euro as it's ever
wow,
been.
Wow, you think so? Seriously?
I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen.
No, no,
I still
no.
think that's the low probability scenario. Right. But I mean, this is a really difficult situation. It's a stalemate. The Greeks want to play for more time. The new government there thinks it has a mandate to focus on its own domestic economy. Europe says, nope, you got to abide by the strict conditions we set in place in the bailout, and you've got to meet those terms. They don't want to do it. I'm not sure how they solve this.
Huh. Neela, thoughts?
Yeah, Kai, you know, the number one reason for divorce in this country is money problems, and that's what we're seeing over in Europe. There's money problems, yeah. and that's why they're arguing so much. But what really resonates with me is this idea of moral hazard that I've been hearing yep. over and over again, that if Europe cuts Greece a break, that they'll somehow do it again, and it will incentivize other countries to also do it. And we heard this in the housing market in terms of cutting a break for all those underwater homeowners. We're hearing it again. I'm not sure that the type of austerity that has been perpetuated on Greece for the last few years is really helping the situation when you have 25% unemployment.
Right.
Rate. Right. Maybe it's time to rethink.
All right, let me try to squeeze one more thing in here, Neela, and it goes to you. The president's budget came out on Monday. Everybody's talking about how the space for compromise is in corporate taxes. Do you believe that might happen?
No, it
Ooh.
Won't happen.
Wow.
Look, corporate taxation is probably the hot button, volatile issue in which to touch.
Yeah,
Everyone
yeah,
agrees
yeah.
on it, except when you actually do it, and then the agreement falls apart. It's all about the details and the application and the execution of it, and that's the problem.
All right, we covered a lot of ground. Neela Richardson from Redfin and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Thank you. Kat.
All right, have a good weekend. Traders did take a while to decide, but it turns out they were not all that wild about the jobs report this morning. I don't know what's up with that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The public health discussion the past month or so hasn't been the Affordable Care Act so much or pharmaceuticals as much as it's been measles and vaccinations to prevent it. The outbreak, 102 cases in January, the CDC says, comes against the backdrop of tight public health budgets and a proposed cut to a federal immunization program. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
Montgomery County, Maryland, is right next to Washington, D.C. So when Washington reported a measles case earlier this week, the county's Department of Health and Human Services shifted into high gear.
Can you give us an update about measles and Right. So the case that in D.C. is...
Cindy Edwards is in charge of the county's communicable disease division, which responds to outbreaks of everything from measles to whooping cough. Part of that response involves vaccinating people who had contact with those who got sick. The county gets much of its vaccine through the federal 317 immunization program, which the Obama administration wants to cut by $50 million, affecting the supply of all kinds of vaccines. Edwards just shakes her head.
To cut money for something that is a proven public health success doesn't make sense.
The 317 program provides vaccine for the uninsured. The White House says there's less demand for 317 vaccines now because more children are insured as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Insurers have to pay for vaccines. Plus, the Obama administration added money to a separate vaccination program for children. But Edwards says a lot of her vaccine goes to adults, many of them immigrants, documented and undocumented.
We've had several measles outbreaks. One was with a refugee population, so we were standing up clinics on Saturdays and Sundays.
While the White House would only cut 317 funding for vaccines, the program funds other things, too. Edwards was able to use it to pay nurses overtime for those weekend clinics and to track down those who were in contact with people who got sick. Some health advocates say more money is needed for things like that. Laura Hanen is a lobbyist for the National Association of County and City Health Officials.
The program has never been fully funded, as it were, and now they're cutting it by $50 million more.
Hanen says 317 program money can also be used to train doctors on how to convince reluctant parents to vaccinate their kids. That's especially important in Western states with lots of unvaccinated or under-vaccinated children. LJ Tan is with the Immunization Action Coalition. He says at least 14% of toddlers in Colorado are not fully vaccinated for measles.
So it's these pockets of under-vaccinated kids that we're worried about. A single case of measles in that community will explode into an outbreak.
And Tan says clinics will need all the 317 immunization program vaccine they can get. Members of Congress aren't immune to these arguments. President Obama proposed cuts to the 317 program last year, but Congress restored the money. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
sell all your investments, sell some, keep all, buy more.
I don't even know what that is, but the story is about the perils of financial advisors, the robo kind. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 60 points on this Friday. It's a 3% closed at 17,824. The NASDAQ dropped 20 points, 0.4%, finished at 4,744. The S&P 500 off 7 points, a 3%, 2,055. For the week, though, the Dow gained 3.7%. The NASDAQ added 2.3%. The S&P 500 rose 3%. You ever read our Yelp review? Not enough of us do. According to investors, the online review site posted its first annual profit, but its growth is slowing, down 21% today. Slowing growth is a big issue for Twitter as well, but investors pretty much gave it a pass today. Twitter added 16% after its profit report yesterday. LinkedIn beat all expectations, jumped 10.6% today. The strong job and wages report that we told you about make it more likely interest rates are going to go up sooner rather than later. Banks like higher interest rates, thus investors like banks. Bank of America led the big banks with a 3.2% gain today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to meet with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. On February 9, 1870, a resolution was passed creating the U.S. Weather Bureau, later named the National Weather Service, making talk about the weather official business. And this month is return shopping carts to the supermarket month, even if it's raining or snowing or sunny. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tesla Motors, as you may have heard, is building the world's biggest battery factory just outside Reno, Nevada. It's going to make batteries for Tesla cars, of course, but it's also working on a bunch of new products for solar and in-home energy storage. And that means, as Marketplace's Adam Allington explains, that in addition to making sexy electric cars, Tesla is also going to be the first significant competition that utility companies have seen in 100 years.
They're calling it the Gigafactory. And when it's up and running in 2016, it's expected to make Tesla's electric cars much more affordable.
In a single factory, we're doubling the worldwide capacity to manufacture lithium-ion batteries.
J.B. Straubel is the chief technology officer for Tesla. In addition to cars, he says Tesla also plans to develop batteries for use with solar, a market he says is ripe for growth.
At the price points that we're expecting to achieve with the Gigafactory, you know, we see a market that's well in excess of the production capability of the factory.
The market for batteries puts an interesting twist on the booming business for solar panels. Will Craven is director of public affairs at California-based Solar City.
We sign up approximately one new customer every minute of the workday.
The way it works now is any excess energy created by solar gets sent back to the grid. The partnership with Solar City, using rooftop solar panels fitted with Tesla battery packs, allows customers to keep that energy in-house. It's what investors call a disruptive technology, and it puts Tesla in direct competition with utility companies. Ben Callow is an analyst with Robert W. Baird.
There are still many utilities out there that, you know, are kind of like their heads stuck in the sand and just hope that this goes away. And what we're seeing is building momentum.
Callow says forward-minded utilities might look at Tesla's disruption as an opportunity. Energy storage technology could be used to build capacity in their existing grids and also build new infrastructure for battery-powered cars and homes. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
As we were talking about up at the beginning of the program, more and more people are finding jobs out there, some of them even seeing their wages tick upward, which will mean there will be some extra cash to play with after people build their savings for emergencies and contribute to their 401ks, of course. Tracy Samuelson is the newest reporter on the Marketplace team, and economic bellwether that she is, she finds herself in just that economic position.
After years of contract work and freelancing, oh, wow, do my personal finances need some love and attention. So step one, figure out what to do with the few thousand dollars I've saved recently with my huge, enormous, glamorous new public radio salary.
Hey, Tracy, we are not biting the hand that feeds us, are we?
Oh, no. Kai, I would never know.
Very good. You may continue. Thank you.
Millennial that I am, I kind of want to try out one of these new online robo-advisors.
What are you looking for in a financial advisor?
Okay, robo-advisors don't actually involve robots. We're talking about a relatively new group of online services that help you decide what to do with your money. But it's more fun to imagine the questions they ask in robot voices. These questions are from Wealthfront.com, an automated, aka human-free investment service.
What is your current age? What is your annual after-tax income? What is the total value of your cash and liquid investments?
The final question is harder. What would I do if my portfolio lost 10% of its value in a month?
Sell all your investments. Sell some. Keep all. Buy more.
I know I shouldn't panic and sell low, but I don't know. Why did my portfolio drop? I guess I'd buy more if I had the money.
It reminds me a little bit of those Facebook, you know, what 90s rock song or is your, you know, rock anthem or, you know, which movie star is your soulmate?
Barbara Roper is director of investor protection at the Consumer Federation of America. She says this is the tricky part about human-free advice.
10 questions and they know supposedly everything about you.
What does Wealthfront know about me? It slots me at a 10 out of 10 on their risk scale, which feels, I don't know, risky? But it recommends I invest in a variety of ETFs or exchange-traded funds. And Roper says this isn't a bad approach, especially if I set it and forget it.
You set up some parameters, you automate the process, you keep expenses as low as possible, you diversify through ETFs, I think is fairly common. Those are good principles.
People considering these robo-advisors might be attracted to their relatively low fees and the fact that, unlike with some human advisors, you don't have to have a lot of money to invest.
So broadly speaking, these services are catering to less affluent individuals.
That's Grant Easterbrook. We spoke when he was an analyst at Corporate Insight covering financial technology.
Most human financial advisors have account minimums. They don't want to work with someone below a certain threshold. They don't think it's worth their time.
By Easterbrook's calculations, the top 11 startups in this space, most of them live for only a year or two, now have $19 billion invested with them, and they're growing fast. That's drawn some bigger banks into the space as well. It's clear there's money to be made, even from smaller investors.
What's going on in your life?
This is Cheryl Garrett, an independent certified financial planner who runs the Garrett Planning Network. I called her because I wanted to know how the advice from my robo-advisor might compare to a good old-fashioned human being. What's going on in my life was the first of her many questions.
And with this new job, what other changes are involved? Did you have to relocate? Is there more commuting? Possibly childcare arrangements?
Do I have debt, a 401k, a Roth IRA? Am I planning to use this money for retirement or a new car in a couple of years, an apartment? Garrett says these kinds of questions can reveal deeper issues in our financial lives that we might not know about.
By just taking time to really look at all of our personal financial lives, what income we have coming in, what costs we may have, or obligations or desires, what other kind of issues do we need to take care of?
Garrett's not opposed to people getting low-cost advice online, even from a robot. But she says automated advice can miss the bigger picture, that the extra money we think we might have might not be truly extra. She says planning first, and maybe, if it still makes sense, internet second. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There will be, when the Oscars come around in a couple of weeks, lots of attention paid to the headline winners. But pay attention when the broadcast winds its way around to the Best Original Score category, because while it's not entirely uncommon for somebody to get two nominations in the same year, it only rarely happens that those nominations are in the same category, as it happened this year. Composer Alexandre Desplat is up for the best score for The Imitation Game and for Grand Budapest Hotel, which you'd think would be enough work for one year. But Desplat also scored Unbroken, The Monuments Men, and Godzilla in 2014. In fact, he has scored more than 40 of Hollywood's biggest films in just the past 5 years. So we called him up, and we got him on the line from his studio in Paris. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for hosting me.
When you score a film, this is an interesting way to start, I guess, but how long does it take for an idea to come into your head?
Well, that's the question you ask to yourself every morning, wondering if you'll be able to deliver in time, because, you know, our work is really related to a deadline, always. But after a while, your system, your brain, is used to pressure, and every day you have to throw a bucket in the well and you bring the water out. There's no other way.
How do you adapt to different films, you know? How do you inspire yourself to write fundamentally different themes?
Well, I guess it's the nature of being a film composer. I wouldn't be happy if I would write the same music over and over. Mm. And that would be the case if I would do the same type of movies all the time. So by being able to collaborate with different directors who offer me different type of musical worlds, I can drift, you know, away from maybe the niche where I would otherwise be put into. Budapest, as you can tell, is a very different sound from Imitation Game, but the films are very different. Even though both films take place during the Second World War, one is fictional, one is non-fictional, and one is a tragedy and a drama. The other one, a comedy drama. So you can't write the same music. You have to find a way of serving the dramaturgy.
When you're working on a film, how does it work? Do you write the music for a couple of scenes and then ship it off to the director and then say Angelina Jolie from Unbroken writes you back and says, Alexandre, yes, I like this, but not this. Please more of this.
Oh, yes. There's a very close collaboration. That's what I like in writing for films. You know, I sit down with the director in my studio when I play piano. I make little electronic demos with orchestration really laid out. And we discuss and we try to picture and I adjust what the movie is calling for and for what the director is aiming for. I'm here to collaborate. I'm not here to create my own piece of music. So it's a very close collaborative job, which I actually really enjoy.
Do you have a favorite score of yours that you've done?
No, because, you know, there's so many different films. I can think of collaborations which I loved, you know, some moments of my life where working with a director on another director was something amazing or an emotion on the podium as I'm conducting the orchestra and I feel, I hear the music and for the first time I feel something I've never felt before. But it's moments, you see, these rare moments of joy.
Do you know, as soon as you have one of those moments of joy, when you've written a piece that does it for you, and you say, "Oh, that's it, I'm done now"?
Yes, of course. Of course, there's a moment when you can feel the melody flowing exactly where you thought it could be going, and you were not right yet finding it, and suddenly it's just there in front of you, unraveling and flawlessly, and that's pure happiness.
Well, Mr. Desplat, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which the market research firm Harris Interactive tells us how we really feel about Goldman Sachs. Goldman came in dead last, even behind AIG, in fact, in Harris's annual poll of the public reputations of what it says are this country's 100 most visible companies. The bottom three, just for Schadenfreude's sake, are Dish Network, AIG, and Goldman. Number one, the Rochester, New York-based Wegmans supermarket. You can get the whole list online. We've got it for you on our website. It is marketplace.org. Check it out. All right, quitting time on a Friday. Today, the Dow off 60 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 20 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 off 7 points, a third of 1%. Pretty good week, though, so don't let Friday get you down. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.